Welcome to this week's edition of KUAR's Week in Review podcast. This week,
Little Rock's police chief makes the rounds to mark his second year of service.
Economic signs point up, but there are some reservations.
Arkansas libertarians are hoping two former governors and an unconventional election cycle will bring good fortune in November.
And a former Seinfeld star is looking to reinvent himself through his directorial debut at the Arkansas Repertory Theater. That's ahead on KUAR's Week in Review. I'm Jacob Kaufman.
And I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotichek.
Sarah, you were here when Little Rock Police got their new police chief, Kenton Buckner, about 2 years ago or so. He just visited a variety of stakeholder groups in the city, a variety of community groups to mark sort of his second year anniversary with the police force. And, you know, he's, of course, come at a time nationally when things like Black Lives Matter are important to a lot of people. From your interview, I listened to it earlier this week, it really seems like you kind of talked about the issues of use of force and technology and accountability systems and where the police department is in Little Rock with all those issues.
Yeah, I wanted to compare what the chief was talking about when he got here with what he's accomplished in 2 years. And some favorable statistics are that the use of force in the department is down. That's over the last 4 years, and crime is down overall. It's at a low not seen since the late 1970s. So some external forces working in the chief's favor. And it seems like he's talked a lot about community policing, and the Department of Justice has recommended a lot of reforms for departments over the nation. But I wanted to just get a sense of his thoughts at this point on that national debate.
I believe that technology has caught up with some of our misdeeds. Technology has exposed some of the corruption in law enforcement. There are folks, citizens, or even chiefs, or people in this profession who are acting as if some of the acts that we have recently been exposed to are new. We must be reminded that Rodney King occurred in 1993. Black and brown communities have been complaining about this treatment for decades. The iPhone and iPads have just caught up with these complaints. So I think that first we have to walk to the podium and accept responsibility for some of the harm that we've caused our communities. I think the community also needs to be mindful of the vast majority of our police officers are professional and do a great job, but then chiefs have to be willing to say that there's probably a small percentage of our agencies who should not be wearing our badge and uniform. I think technology with the on-body cameras is something that I believe that will drastically change our profession. You immediately have somewhat of an independent witness that will be able to give an account for what has happened. While it is not a perfect tool, I think it will be an effective tool. But we also must be mindful that it does not always capture everything. So it's certainly not a penicillin pill for the problems that we have.
So, Sarah, Chief Buckner talked about one potential way of accountability through the use of body cameras and things like that. And he said personally that he takes responsibility and police must take responsibility for when there are inappropriate acts or use of force. Did he say what practice or mechanism of review he thinks would be best going forward, or what he's looking at into year three?
Well, asked him about Judge Wendell Griffin's proposition that the police department have a external use of force review process. Right now, there's an internal process. So anytime there's a use of force issue or police-involved shooting, police officers review the situation. And that in the past, in some prominent cases, that has not been thoroughly adequate to identify problems. So the police chief said, well, he's not going to rule that out. He wants some more specific terms. You know, it really depends to him on what the powers of that board would be. And it seems like the public debate in Little Rock has not continued so much on this issue to the point where there are any real firm proposals coming to him or any kind of interest or, you know, push to really do that.
When you talked to Chief Buckner, did you get the sense then that if there is going to be this external review committee that's not within the police department, that that's going to have to be something, even though he might be sort of agreeable to the idea of that, he said, told you? Is that going to have to be an idea that is pushed from outside? Is that kind of what he's indicating, that he's not going to come up with the structure of this himself?
Yeah, and it seems like he'd be agreeable to it depending on the terms of it. So he's definitely seemed reluctant, I would say. And it's not, you know, it's really coming from, as far as I know, Wendell Griffin, not necessarily taking steam as an idea in town.
Because Chief Buckner certainly could propose it just as equally as any regular citizen.
Right. And similarly, when he was holding community forums last fall, I guess it was, people asked him if he would invite a Department of Justice review of the police department, and he said no.
Yeah, I guess not a lot of people invite an outside review from the federal government, though, to be fair to him. But
not too often, I guess. But I guess I can't think of an instance of a department this year doing it, but I think it has happened.
Proactively,
yeah,
seeking those solutions. Okay, let's switch gears a little bit, or not too much, though, because oftentimes low crime, as the police department is reporting, has to do with good economic conditions. There's a few different economic indicators we got in this week. One, the state revenue report. Generally, the revenue numbers were a little bit below forecast for the month of May, but they're above levels compared to last year, so state economic officials feel pretty good about it. I'll just read a few different things here. For May last month, the gross general revenue fell 1.7% below forecast, and sales tax collections, more notably, were 11% below expectations. And this is maybe having a little bit more interest than normal because the governor just passed a highway tax plan that would take surplus money for the first time. This was the 11th month of our fiscal year, and going into it, we have $105 million surplus above forecast. That's 3.5% above year-ago levels, although sales tax collections are still down overall for the year, about 9%. I spoke to John Shelnut, who's an economist with the Department of Finance Administration. He said other than sort of a mild winter, which led to low energy consumption, and a one-time around $8 million court settlement that the state had to pay regarding sales taxes, that generally he thinks things are pretty much on track with forecast and outperforming last year as well.
We would be essentially on forecast were it not for that one-time refund, which was related to a court case. Beyond that, also in sales tax, we had probably our last month of negative effects of the warm winter in the utility portion of sales tax.
So not anything totally unsurprising. Most things are pretty much on track in terms of the state revenue numbers. There were a few odd exceptions that we didn't talk about too much, though, like drinking taxes way up, the amount of people doing gambling or games of skill, rather, way up this year, too. But so that's the state revenue issue. We got some more details on unemployment numbers today. As we're taping this podcast on Friday, we got the U.S. unemployment rate, doesn't have the state breakdown yet. It fell to 4.7%, though there's the worst hiring in 5 years despite unemployment falling. And we also got some breakdowns into different metropolitan areas of Arkansas. Arkansas has a record low unemployment rate of, I think it was 3.4% last month, but we got breakdowns of individual cities. As could be expected, Northwest Arkansas, which is this week having their Walmart shareholders annual conference, Fayetteville, Springdale, Rogers area has 2.4% unemployment for April compared to 3.8% of April of last year. Fort Smith is at 4.1%, Hot Springs 3.5%, Jonesboro 2.8%, and the Little Rock, North Little Rock Conway area is at 3%, or 3% in April, and it was 3.66% just last month. So pretty big drop for 1 month, I'd say. So that's kind of the issue there. Pine Bluff, as always, seems to be doing a little bit more poorly than the rest of the state, 4.6% unemployment. West Memphis has 4.4% unemployment.
Great.
So that's the economic snapshot of the moment. Nothing particularly troubling. State officials certainly aren't acting too worried about it. On the political side of things, not that busy of a week. The legislature didn't have a special session this week. We don't have too much going on in the presidential race outside of the norm, except for the Libertarian Party. The National Libertarian Party selected their delegates to run for president at a convention in Orlando. And UALR economist, who we sometimes use for unemployment numbers, Michael Pacco, happens to be the state Libertarian Party chair. He was in Orlando. He said it's his fifth convention he's been to. This was the craziest one, the biggest one. There are over 200 media credentialed people there. And the reason being because we're in such a crazy election year with Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton both having very high unfavorability ratings. And plus, the Libertarian Party, they ended up nominating two former governors. So in their eyes, you know, these candidates are somewhat serious compared to other people. Gary Johnson is the presidential candidate, and Weld, the former Massachusetts governor, is the vice presidential candidate. Both had to be nominated separately. Here's Michael Pacco, though, talking about those Libertarian nominees. Even though they're governors and seem somewhat credible, that might pose a problem if you're a Libertarian. Why would you want to elect a Republican to the head of your ticket?
There certainly is a tension. On the one hand, to have two former governors on our ticket would be that lends some credibility to the ticket and the gravitas that brings. On the other hand, to have two former Republican governors does smack of Republican light, and there are some delegates who would like to see some of the more experienced, long-term members of the party represent us on the national stage. So that's really going to be one of the underlying issues as we go through the nomination process here.
You know, I asked Michael Pacco about these two candidates, if he thinks this is a once-in-a-lifetime sort of opportunity for the Libertarian Party, given the presidential race being so kind of chaotic and unpredictable or unconventional. And he said, yes, that is part of it. But of course, as a good party faithful member, he said, well, the Libertarians are simply on the national stage now because our ideas have come around, which is, expected sort of. But he didn't have expectations that were too high. He doesn't quite think that they'll probably win the election.
Well, I think the Libertarian ideas really are starting to catch on with the public. There are some issues that the Libertarian Party has been backing for a long time that are now mainstream thinking in many quarters. I think that having some credible, well-known candidates on the ticket is going to help us, and especially given the candidates from the other parties. But I think we are on the rise.
So if the immediate goal is not to sweep into the White House, what is it? Well, it's something a little less ambitious, but equally as important, perhaps, for the state Libertarian Party.
Well, I think the most important number that we're looking at in Arkansas is we'd like to see our candidate get 3% of the vote. The way that state election laws are set up in Arkansas, the only way that the Libertarian Party will retain ballot access without having to start the petitioning process all over again next time is if our presidential candidate gets 3% of the vote. It doesn't matter what any of our other candidates do. That's the only criterion.
Gary Johnson, this year's presidential nominee, was also the 2012 nominee for the Libertarian Party. He got less than 1% of the vote nationally, did a little bit better in Arkansas with about 1.5% of the vote. So it's within the realm of possibility to get that 3%, probably. Well, Sarah, this week you got to not only have one nice long sit-down interview with the police chief, but two long nice sit-down interviews. You also spoke with a little bit not quite serious of a subject, Jason Alexander, of course, of Seinfeld and George Costanza fame. He is trying to be a director now. He's going to have a play at the Rep.
And he told me he's been a director his whole life since high school. So
we've all been directors.
He said that his friend wrote this play and he's been meaning to direct it. This is the world premiere of Windfall, a play about a data processing firm where disgruntled workers with a tyrannical boss get together as a last-ditch effort to pool more money than they have to play the lottery. So I spoke with him about directing the play and what he likes about it, his foray into directing here. Mr. Alexander, thank you so much for speaking with me today about your work on Windfall here in Little Rock.
My pleasure.
Can you explain a bit about the play? I understand it's about some disgruntled workers in a data processing company who sort of take things into their own hands. What's exciting to you about this story?
Well, first of all, it's a brand new play, so it's really cool to pick away at something that no one has cracked before, because every show is a mystery. You got to figure out what works, what doesn't work, how to do it. So that's fun because nobody has a blueprint for it. But the play itself should relate to people on a lot of levels. It is about people working in a very sort of mind-numbing, soul-sucking, dead-end job. And they work for a guy who's incredibly abusive. And they have formed their own alliances to survive. And you think those alliances will support you and keep you sane and keep you emotionally healthy. And one of the things they do to bond with each other is they play the lottery, the way a lot of offices do. A lot of people will just, they'll throw in their $5 a week and they'll go, hey, if we hit it, we'll split it. And in this case, they take an extraordinary risk beyond their means to win it big. And because of that, these tensions arise. And all those alliances and all those relationships and all that support turns on a dime. And the play is ultimately about the destructive power of greed and money and, how dreams and wishes and that for which you have nothing you can do. Scooter, the playwright, believes that the lottery is basically a giant scam. It's bad gambling, as he says, because nothing that you bring to the table, it has nothing to do with your personality, your smarts, your merit, nothing. So he feels it's a ridiculous way to dream about value and dream about success, and that the realities of the situation, once it falls apart, all has to do is proof positive that these relationships were not sound, that they weren't real, that greed corrupts all and corrupts absolutely. And the play becomes very frenzied and crazy, and people wind up doing very, very bad things.
So most of our listeners will probably know you primarily from Seinfeld and all many other aspects of your career, but can you tell me a bit about how you got into directing and how you were drawn to work on this project in particular? Do you have a relationship pre-existing with a writer?
So directing has been a part of my life since college. I went to Boston University and I was an acting and directing major. I've always been intrigued with directing because it's you take the job you do as an actor and then you multiply it by every number of actors and the writer and all the design people. You just get to deal with a lot more people. A show, a movie, a television show, a play, they're all a puzzle. How are we going to do it? And actors only get to provide one piece of the puzzle. Directors get to sort of step back and look at all the pieces and go, oh, I think if we assemble it this way, it might be pretty. And that's a lot more fun for me than the joy of performance you don't get as a director, but you get a lot of other joys instead. How I came to this play is, this is the first play that my friend Scooter, and I know he sounds like a little kid with a beanie cap on, but he's actually a grown and wonderful man. Scooter Peach wrote this play, and Scooter is by profession a composer. He's written a lot of music for reality television and some popular songs and whatnot. But he's been a prolific playwright for a number of years, but he's never had anything of his own produced. And I've read many of his plays, and they're all interesting, good characters, good ideas. This one I thought was particularly further along. And I met Scooter through our mutual friend Brian Cranston. Brian was interested in being in another of Scooter's plays and asked if I would direct it, and then Brian's career kind of went through the ceiling, and he just didn't have time to do that play. And Scooter and I have remained friends, and I saw a reading of this play because he wrote it, and then he just wanted to hear actors read it so he could see what he had. And I went to that reading and said, I think you may really have something here. And then we started working together, and I started guiding him through some rewrites, that's how it's developed. But it's great fun. If I could make 80% of my career directing at this point, I would do it. It's just that when you try to establish, I've been an actor for so long primarily, that when you say, well, I'm kind of directing now, there's a whole bunch of people who have been directing all along, and they're on the list ahead of you. So you have to do something notable and successful, and then you move up the list. But, you know, it's all fine.
And so I know that you've done comedy throughout your career, and this has been pegged as a dark comedy. Mm-hmm. Can you explain a bit what that means?
A dark comedy is kind of one where you hate yourself for laughing, because the comedy is coming at great expense for the characters who are in it. So it's not a lighthearted comedy where you have, I'm trying to think of a good lighthearted comedy, in the classical sense, would be Cyrano de Bergerac. So this silly man is in love with this beautiful woman, and he doesn't know how to speak to her, so he hires this ugly man who's an amazing wordsmith, and the girl falls in love with the words and overlooks the man's ugliness. And it's all very lighthearted and fun, and nobody gets hurt, you know, or at least not profoundly hurt. You never sit there and go, oh, I feel really bad now, if you're in the audience. A dark comedy is, the stakes are much higher, people are really getting hurt, the things that you're laughing about can be violent, they can be criminal, they can be people's ugliest emotions, and you're laughing anyway. That makes for a dark comedy. And they're if you can pull them off, they are very compelling, and people tend to remember them longer, even though it's not just a lot of what I've done in my career, which is just in entertainment. Entertainments are great. They certainly have their place. But if you can create something that has a little more substance to it, it tends to stay with an audience longer.
And so aside from the nature of human greed, what do you hope the audience will leave Windfall musing about in terms of themes and big sort of existential issues?
You know, what would be fun, I think, is for people to just go out thinking, well, what would I do? What would I do if I was in that office? Who would I be? Would I be the best me, or would I be just getting through it, or would I kind of give in and be the worst me? And if I was in that situation, if I really thought I had made an investment that I couldn't afford to make and somebody was cheating me, to what lengths would I go? Where would my rage, or where would my injustice or desperation lead me? If you can actually leave there going, huh, I wonder how I'd handle this if it were me, that's a great experience to have, whether it be a play, a book, or whatever it may be. If it leaves you thinking, how does that world affect me, that's fantastic.
Have you figured it out for yourself?
I often think, I haven't done it in this scenario. I have been, for better or worse, privy to people who have had health issues that I think are debilitating and horrifying. And I know what I'm like. If I have a headache, I'm cranky. And they have really big issues. And they're fantastic. They treat people wonderfully. They're optimistic and outgoing about life. And they get through it. They eat the discomfort, and they deal with it, and they remain good people. And I always go, I think I would be the most miserable so-and-so on the planet. I can't. I would hope to rise to their level, but I have a feeling I may not have it in me. So I don't know what I would do in an office like this. I would hope that I would never have to take this job.
Jason Alexander, thank you so much. You're in Little Rock for a few weeks directing Windfall. A pleasure to speak with you.
Thanks, Sarah.
When you talked to Jason Alexander, is he living in Little Rock right now, or is he just commuting to work on the play?
He's just here for a few weeks.
But okay, is he here pretty much during the entire time during these few weeks? Tell us where he lives and what restaurants he goes to.
In Little Rock?
Yeah.
I think he said he lived in the Hillcrest area, and I asked him if he had been to the Big Dam Bridge, and he had. And so he couldn't quite remember the name of the neighborhood he was staying in, so
right.
I don't get the sense that he is like doing a walking tour of the city.
I'm just saying people have a few more weeks to look at him, maybe. Out on the street corner and see if he's there. So he's, of course, very famous from other roles he's done. Did you have any difficulty when you're interviewing him calling him Jason Alexander instead of George?
You mean George instead of Jason?
Yes.
I think I know what you're getting at because you've been teasing me about it all week long. Yeah. At the end of our interview, I said, thank you, George Alexander, thank you for speaking with me. And he sort of laughed and grimaced and said, try Jason Alexander. He said, I get that all the time. So poor man can't get
there
away
you go.
From it.
Well, I just wanted, to reward anyone who's listening this late into the podcast with that bit of trivia. Okay. Well, that's been our week in review. It's pretty light week, I think, but it's pretty fun week. You can check out this podcast anywhere you get podcasts, iTunes, those sorts of places, KUAR.org. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Our theme music is compiled by Chris Hickey, who's out in San Antonio, one of his many former homes, on his birthday this week. So we'll have him back next week. Thanks for listening. I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotecheck.